Coming up, as ISIS ramps up recruiting efforts in the West, Kim Lawton looks at new initiatives by U.S. Muslim groups trying to prevent violent extremism from taking hold here. Also, Fred DeSam Lazaro on the sacred cows of India, an estimated 40,000 of them on the streets of Delhi alone. And Jewish women celebrating Purim and the story of Queen Esther.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. This week, ISIS militants launched a wave of attacks on a series of Christian villages in Syria, burning churches and taking hundreds of hostages. Faith groups continued raising alarms about ISIS violence plaguing the region. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops urged the U.S. to give religious minorities in the Middle East more protection. The group cited Pope Francis, saying it was permissible to use force to stop these, quote, unjust aggressors. Meanwhile, a video was released online this week showing ISIS militants in Iraq destroying priceless Assyrian artifacts dating back to the 7th century. In the video, the men called the statues idols. Top Muslim leaders from around the world this week issued a statement calling for reforms in religious studies to promote moderation and tolerance. The statement came at the end of an anti-terrorism conference held in Mecca. Clerics, scholars, and academics attended the meeting. They said Muslim extremists are distorting the image of Islam. Some European Muslims are also working to counter perceptions of Islam generated by extremist violence. After recent attacks on several Jewish targets across Europe, young Muslims in Oslo, Norway, organized what they called a Ring of Peace to protect the city's main synagogue. More than 1,000 people surrounded the synagogue in a show of interfaith solidarity. Here in the U.S., three Muslim men from Brooklyn were arrested this week and charged with providing material support to ISIS. The arrests highlight concerns about the extent to which ISIS is recruiting Muslims in the West to join their cause. Studies show that only a tiny percentage of American Muslims are committing terrorist acts or leaving to fight with ISIS. Still, in the face of the challenge, many U.S. Muslim groups are launching initiatives to prevent violent extremism from taking hold in their communities. Kim Lawton has our report.
In Washington, D.C., Imam Zia Makhdoom and his wife Fatima Popel are participating in an annual Interfaith Unity Walk.
We're probably going to need another box for this.
They've brought along members of Make Space, the group they founded in 2012 for young Muslims. It's been a full day of learning about other religious traditions and doing a service project, making meals for the homeless. The couple says activities like this build a positive self-identity among young American Muslims. And they believe that will help prevent the youth from becoming susceptible to extremist ideas.
We want to feel as though we are part of the society. You can be a Muslim and an American at the same time.
You can't just say I'm an American and then not give back to your country. So this is an opportunity to bridge gaps and to create dialogue and positive dialogue.
As ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist groups ramp up their recruiting efforts in the West, many Islamic organizations in the U.S. are launching new initiatives aimed at preventing radicalization. They say while the number of American Muslims seeking to commit acts of terror is small, the issue must be addressed.
Our biggest problem as Muslims and what we're facing right now is extremism. We need to nip it in the bud, and that is creating these healthy communities, and not just here in America, but all around the world, so that Muslims can talk about these issues in an open environment and really take back our faith.
But it's been a controversial prospect. Some Muslims fear new projects to combat extremism will imply that the problem is bigger than it really is. And other Muslim voices are pushing for even more internal critique.
The pathway to get there does involve airing dirty laundry, does involve open public acknowledgement that we have core interpretations, not the scripture, but interpretations of the scripture that need to be modernized and are used by radicals.
Earlier this year, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, MPAC, released its Safe Spaces Initiative, which the group describes as a toolkit to help mosques and local community centers combat violent extremism. MPAC national policy analyst Hoda El-Shastawi says they recommend a multi-step process, which starts with holistic projects to help prevent extremism from ever taking hold.
Usually what we found in a majority of these cases is that troubled individuals really have underlying issues, whether it's mental health issues, family issues at home, that these issues are not being dealt with. So our prevention programs are creating these safe spaces so that people can talk about issues and grievances that they have and work through them in a healthy way.
Imam Makhdoom says his Make Space group tries to provide a constructive platform for discussion of grievances about things like perceived discrimination and racial profiling or disagreements with U.S. foreign policy.
And so we seek God's guidance and we seek His mercy and we seek His assistance in all our affairs.
He believes religious education is another key element for preventing radicalization.
The more they understand Islam and the teaching of Islam, the less likely they are to fall for that kind of thing. And research has shown that.
The Quran really is a book about choices, right?
Makhdoom and a growing number of American Muslim leaders are taking their message online to try and reach young people through social media, the very place ideological extremists often wield the most influence.
It's important for the sane voices, the moderate voices, the true authentic voices of Islam to take the battle to them.
If an individual appears to be moving toward radicalization, MPAC urges community and religious leaders to surround that person in a proactive intervention. And after that, if the person seems to be moving toward violence, MPAC advises he or she should be ejected from the community with the knowledge of law enforcement. Across the country, Muslim groups have been trying to build good relationships with law enforcement to facilitate this. But El-Shastawi says there have been several points of tension.
You can talk about FBI tactics with informants. You can talk about the use of surveillance, widespread surveillance. There are real issues that we need to deal with as American Muslims and as we build those relationships with law enforcement.
In Phoenix, Arizona, Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery has been meeting with members of the local Muslim community in an effort he hopes can be a model for other cities. He says trust needs to go both ways.
It can be challenging at times because of the continuing need to maintain that open dialogue and communication. It's too easy for people to fall back on stereotypes, whether out of ignorance or an outright effort to discriminate. So it's that constant communication that's required.
Even if someone is identified as a radical, Montgomery says often there's only so much law enforcement can do. That puts much of the responsibility back on the Muslim community.
We don't have a future crime squad, and we don't have thought police, but rather to bring those individuals to the attention of local community leaders who can help clarify what is and is not acceptable in authentic Islamic teaching.
One of the Muslim leaders Montgomery meets with regularly is Dr. Zudi Jasser, president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy and a member of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom.
Allahu Akbar.
He says he's pleased more Muslim groups are trying to combat any extremism before it turns to violence. But he believes many of the new initiatives don't go deep enough in addressing ideology, what he calls the battle for the soul of Islam.
We love our faith, but we want to have a debate about what entails the identification and the laws and the rules of that faith. We need to have a vibrant criticism, critique of our ideologies so that we can grow.
Jasser has generated strong controversy within the Muslim community. He's highly critical of political Islam and urges what he calls the separation of mosque and state. He says sermons in too many U.S. mosques are focused on grievances.
Unfortunately, You know, there's just so much demonization of America that it becomes fodder for those kids that go off and become radicals to then feel they're justified in their acts of terror.
Jasser founded the Muslim Liberty Project to promote American values among young Muslim leaders. Courtney Lonergan and Seema Kassab lead the Muslim Liberty Project at Arizona State University. Lonergan is a convert to Islam who says she's been shocked by the level of anger she's heard inside some parts of the U.S. Muslim community.
I work with so many young people, it's easy just to take the blame somebody else and take the victim mindset. Oh, poor me, this is what happened. And there's not a lot that's happening in the community to empower young people.
The issue is that most Muslims aren't like that, but we have to go out there and show people that. We have to show the world that Muslims themselves.
If you instill in our youth and in our Muslim communities a love and passion for America, for liberty, for a nation state based in freedom, that all people are equal, they would never be radicalized.
Hoda El-Shastawi says it's important to tackle the problem of extremism without condemning all of Islam or fomenting anti-Muslim bigotry. She says American Muslims won't allow their faith to be defined by ISIS.
They are destruction. They have nothing to do with building of life, whereas Islam is about enjoining what is good. It's about life. It's about preserving human rights, dignity, justice. And so what we've seen is that Muslims now are taking back that narrative.
She says grassroots, community-wide efforts are the only way that can happen. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
In other news, an Indian Jesuit priest who was abducted in Afghanistan nearly 8 months ago was released this week. 47-year-old Father Alexis Prem Kumar had been working as the country director of Jesuit Refugee Service when he was taken captive by an unknown group of armed men. He said he was grateful to be free and didn't know why he had been abducted. Meanwhile, an American missionary with the Free Methodist Church was kidnapped in central Nigeria this week. Armed gunmen stormed the Hope Academy compound and captured 70-year-old Reverend Phyllis Sorter. She's reportedly being held for a $300,000 ransom. Local authorities say they aren't sure if the kidnappers are part of the Boko Haram terrorist group. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in the case of a Muslim teenager in Tulsa who was denied employment at an Abercrombie and Fitch clothing store because of her hijab. She was told that her headscarf violated a company policy that states how store workers should look. Many religious groups came out in support of the woman, saying she'd been discriminated against because of her faith.
She could not remove her headscarf for a job interview without remaining true to herself, and Abercrombie refused to hire her because she was true to her religious beliefs.
Abercrombie and Fitch says it was not discrimination because the teenager never mentioned that she wore the scarf for religious reasons. As the Supreme Court prepares to hear a key gay marriage case in April, a group of conservative evangelicals, among them the Family Research Council and the National Religious Broadcasters, this week urged the justices not to force acceptance of same-sex marriage on all states and citizens. The activists said their religious beliefs do not allow them to support gay marriage in any way. They pledged new efforts to help business owners such as bakers and florists who are facing large fines for refusing to provide their services for same-sex weddings. We have a Fred DeSam Lazaro story today on the cows of India. Hindu traditions teach that cows are sacred, so Indians share even their most modern cities with many thousands of cows. Hindus protect them in the streets and take care of them until they die.
It may look like an unusual petting zoo, but this is actually a place of reverence to many people in India. This gaushala, or cow shelter, is one of three in India's capital, Delhi. It serves as both barn and sanctuary for 6,000 urban cows. Most are abandoned by their owners to fend for themselves in a mega city of 17 million.
In the Hindu religion, if you take care of cows, your family will prosper and you will have peace. Your children will have a good spiritual life. God will look after them.
Cows are considered sacred in Hinduism. They're the favorite animal of the deity Lord Krishna and a symbol of wealth, strength, and abundance. The cow's spiritual significance is likely also tied to its very practical role in India since ancient times. The veneration of cows quite likely traces back millennia and to its utility on farms for transportation. Cow's milk, butter, and yogurt are important sources of protein in a vegetarian diet by which many Hindus abide. In rural areas, cow dung is used for fuel, and even the urine is collected for use in traditional medicine.
The slaughter of cows is illegal in many parts of India, and even McDonald's, the world's largest hamburger chain, doesn't serve any beef in its India outlets.
But McDonald's is part of India's growing urban landscape. Delhi is a city that's grown farther and farther out into what once was rural land.
When they were on farms, these animals used to work. They pulled carts and plows. Now machines have come in and there's much less use for them. Now people don't have that much space for cows.
An estimated 40,000 of the animals roam freely on the streets of Delhi. They are increasingly seen as a nuisance, clogging traffic and foraging through garbage heaps. And they've become a target for poachers.
We live with people of another religion. Some people of that religion, and I do say some, because there are people in that religion that also honor and serve cows, but some people pick them up from the road.
He was referring to some people among India's Muslims. Muslims do consume beef, but sociologists say there's growing beef consumption among Hindus as well, in an increasingly globalized urban India. A single cow can fetch as much as 5,000 rupees, about $90, on the underground market, a big payday here. The cow shelters rely on the faithful to get to the animals first.
People call in to tell us there is a cow on the street or wandered into our home. We provide transportation to bring them in. Some people bring them in themselves and leave them here.
The shelters are supported by public donations, which flowed in abundantly the day we visited, from people who came in to pray and to feed the animals.
We don't ask people to give money. As you saw today, they just come in. When you add together all the money from those who give, all the way from 100,000 rupees to thousands to small amounts, we get about 30 million rupees a year.
That's about $500,000 to allow the animals to live out their natural lives in peace.
Cows have to die, but we don't want them to die of hunger or thirst.
It's a far cry from the grassy rural range that is the more natural habitat, but these animals do have cooling fans and an abundant, if somewhat unusually varied diet, as throngs of devout people preserve or restore the historical reverence for India's urban cow. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Delhi, India.
Father Theodore Hesburgh, the distinguished former president of the University of Notre Dame, died this week. Hesburgh was president of Notre Dame from 1952 to 1987. He helped transform the school into a premier academic institution. He was considered one of the most influential Catholic leaders of the past century, widely respected by those inside and outside the church. He was 97 years old. On our calendar this week, on Sunday evening, Baha'is begin their 19-day fast when they abstain from food and water from sunrise to sunset. And next Friday, Hindus celebrate Holi, the spring festival of colors. They throw colored water and powder on each other to mark the triumph of good over evil. Also this coming week, Jews celebrate Purim and the heroic story in the Book of Esther of how one woman, Esther, risked her life long ago to protect her people. We visited a special women's Purim celebration complete with costumes at the Washington Heights congregation in New York, also known as the Bridge Shul. Again, Kim Lawton reports.
In this Orthodox synagogue in New York City, congregants are fulfilling the traditional Purim requirement that Jews hear the biblical book of Esther, known as the Megillah, read aloud. The center's sanctuary is usually reserved for men, but on this day, all of the listeners and readers are women.
There aren't that many opportunities for women to read in front of a group of other people from a scroll. That's sort of mostly reserved for men, for the most part, in the Orthodox community.
Well, in all Jewish rituals, men have tended to take a greater role. Men are obliged in certain commandments which women are not obliged in, and therefore they carry them out.
For Purim, traditionally that has meant women listen as one man reads the story of Esther to the entire congregation of both men and women.
In the last couple of generations, we've seen a great increase in Jewish learning amongst women. Women have said, well, we are also obliged in a commandment, we can take a leading role.
To encourage that, the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance has launched Project Esther, an online resource which includes an international directory of women's readings and celebrations. It also features an app that can be downloaded to help women learn how to chant the Megillah themselves or follow along as they listen to others.
You can turn on and off the punctuation marks that tell you the notes of how to read, and then you can try practicing without it because the actual scroll has no markings at all.
For the last several years, this group of Orthodox women has been holding their Purim celebrations in often cramped private apartments. So they welcomed the synagogue's invitation to hold their annual reading here. The Book of Esther recounts the story of how a plot to destroy the Jewish people is foiled in ancient Persia thanks to the heroics of women. The story is set in motion when the king has his first wife, Vashti, banished and likely put to death after she refuses to appear at his drunken feast.
Vashti definitely has an appeal as a character because she refuses what the king wants, and so I think that resonates with a lot of people.
The king holds a beauty contest and selects Esther to succeed Vashti as queen. But Esther's uncle, Mordechai, tells her she must keep her Jewish identity hidden.
In the beginning, Esther is kind of a passive character, and she goes along with all that's happening and what other people tell her to do, but at some point she becomes more active, and some people say she takes on a little bit of a similar characteristic to that of Vashti, which is kind of taking a stance and saying what she wants and she believes needs to happen.
When the king's close advisor devises a plot to annihilate the Jews, Esther must approach the king to plead for the salvation of her people.
Esther rises to the opportunity that God gives her. She goes into the king's inner chamber. She doesn't know whether she'll be put to death. The law in Persia was if you went in to see the king and you weren't invited, then you would be put to death unless he extended his golden scepter towards you to indicate he wanted to hear you and save your life. And when she walked in, she didn't know whether she would live or die. And she took that great risk for her people.
The villain of the story is Haman, or Haman, a descendant of the Amalek tribe who were traditional enemies of the Jews and sought their destruction.
He symbolizes all anti-Semitism over all time. When Haman's name is mentioned, we all make noise in order to blot out his name.
In the story, Esther is welcomed by the king and Haman's plot fails. The Jewish people are saved and their enemies are killed instead.
Purim is really a story about turnaround, about the unexpected happening. And the dressing up is an indication of how things are not what they seem.
Alton says the dressing up in costume is also a hint about the hidden nature of God.
The name of God never appears in the Book of Esther. But the story of the Book of Esther is really that God is always behind the story. God is hidden behind the text of the Megillah, and we hide ourselves behind masks and costumes on Purim. It's a story of salvation from physical destruction, so we celebrate it in a physical way.
It's a great story, just from a purely literary perspective, and at its center is a woman. That's pretty unusual.
Her character, over the course of the story, goes from very passive to very active. So it's a nice way to celebrate that by doing something really proactive in the community.
And part of that means fulfilling one of the other commandments of Purim, giving donations to the poor, traditionally given so that others who are less fortunate can join in the celebration as well. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more scenes from Hindu celebrations of Holi.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.